from Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, a special report commemorating the 50th anniversary of the 1964 Democratic Convention in Atlantic City, where the Mississippi Freedom Democratic delegation showed up and tried to get seated. Fannie Lou Hamer spoke before the Credentials Committee at the Democratic Party Convention. This is some of what she had to say.
Mr. Chairman, and to the Credentials Committee, my name is Mrs. Fannie Lou Hamer, and I live at 626 East Lafayette Street, Roseville, Mississippi, Sunflower County, the home of Senator James O. Eastland and Senator Stennis. It was the 31st of August in 1962 that 18 of us traveled 26 miles to the county courthouse in Indianola to try to register to become first-class citizens. We was met in Indianola by policemen, highway patrolmen, and they only allowed two of us in to take the literacy test at the time.
Professor Kalia Liddell Lafayette Clark was a young college student at the time. She had worked with Medgar Evers, the Student Nonviolence Coordinating Committee, or SNCC, and other groups to enroll black voters across the southern United States. Some, like Evers, were killed. Others were terrorized by mobs and police. But they forced the Democratic Party to end its system of segregation among its delegates and ended up forcing President Lyndon B. Johnson and the Congress to enact the Voting Rights Act the following year. This is Professor Clark in an interview Wednesday.
Hello. I just really want to talk to the world just a bit and remembering three great women, Fannie Lou Hamer, Annie Devine, and Vicki. Oh, my goodness, I'm really getting old here now. But three great women, one from Hattiesburg, Mississippi, one from Canton, Mississippi, and, of course, Fannie Lou Hamer from Louisville, Mississippi. As we remember these women, I was in Chicago in 64. We sat down 72 young people, trained them, well, all ages actually, but certainly 72 people who were committed to coming to Mississippi for the Mississippi Summer Project to work on specifically the right to vote. But you couldn't work on the right to vote in Mississippi without working on all the other civil rights issues and poverty and trying to figure out how to help people just live, because it was dire poverty in most of the state. Jackson, Mississippi, where I grew up, was not as tough, but it was tough as well. I went to school with young people who didn't have shoes or socks oftentimes, or who didn't have food. I had casserole sandwiches, something that most people in the nation have probably never heard of. But white and black in Mississippi, who were both in poverty, large sections of the white community, knew what a casserole sandwich was. It was parent trying to keep children alive in any way that they could keep them alive. So the summer came and the call came out, and young college students, primarily young white college students from around the country, were making their way to Mississippi. They came by bus, they came by train, they came by car. The groups that we sent out of Illinois went by car with the advice that they not ride white and black together, but they ride separately so that they could get into Ohio, and be at Oxford in Ohio, get the training, and then get to Mississippi to get the work done, because the focus was on getting the work done rather than on trying to make a statement about desegregation. So the young people went. And we formed in Chicago the Illinois Freedom Democratic Party. I was not a big part of the work on that, but was a member of that and did work with that. We also set up that summer in Chicago, under the SNCC umbrella, a fundraising unit. And that fundraising unit brought everybody to Chicago across the summer with a voice to raise funds for Mississippi radio stations in parking lots with cans. We did everything we could to make sure that money was coming into Mississippi. But this was a period when we had to do work to lead up to the summer of 64. In fact, there were folk like me that were very discouraged that there was a summer of 64. I thought it was called prematurely, because growing up in Mississippi, the one thing I knew, that any white could tell you what to do. So the whites were coming from the north to tell you to go get registered to vote, something that you had not responded to with black workers. Then you would go get registered to vote because a white person said it. And this would mean that the issue of leadership was not being thought through fully. We wanted blacks to be able to respond to blacks, to be able to get up on their own initiative and go get registered to vote, to face the mobs, to face the sheriffs, to face the lynchers, or whatever we had to face to get the job done. Now, this had been true in Mississippi under Bob Moses. Whites would come in and do work here, there, but they never really were staff members. There were 16 staff members. We were all black. There were only two females on that staff initially, and it would expand as I was leaving Mississippi, getting married and off to Alabama in the summer of 62. Well, excuse me, the fall of 62. So looking back across that time period, and then looking forward at what was being asked for 64, it was probably also a little bit of, how should I say, a jealousy that we didn't think of this in the early days. It could have been done, but it was something to be done. So whites were arriving, and blacks were responding. And I'm sure there were blacks who were responding because they were white. But there was another movement afoot. There was another thinking afoot. The work that we had done had brought good fruit. And people were responding because they had help and responding because now they knew that if whites were there, there would be PR, press, would be focused on what was happening in Mississippi and the potential for them living through an attempt to register to vote would be eyewitness news worldwide. So this was essentially what was happening. But I started my work with SNCC in 62. Worked with Megger Evers. Our focus was on, of course, voter registration. Megger's work has always been on voter registration. But our main focus had been on trying to get people to understand that they needed to make some kind of a move. They needed to begin to report incidents of lynchings and violence, which was regular. And 99% of the lynchings, I can tell you, have not been reported. That is why during the summer of 64, in dredging for the three young men in the river, they just pulled up body, bones after bones, or body after body, till finally the FBI just decided to call it off. And our national civil rights leadership at the time, including Dr. King, didn't say, you drag the rivers. You show the world what America is. That these rivers are filled with the bodies of men and women who probably had small infractions, not necessarily challenges to the right to vote, not necessarily challenges to civil liberties, basic civil rights, but they're in the river. And so those things came up during the summer and got kind of pushed back under. But this had been the life that we had lived, not just in Mississippi, but all across the country, but certainly in the deep South. That's what I know best. So during the July of 62, we formed the Council of Federated Organizations, under which will come the Freedom Democratic Party. And it is that Freedom Democratic Party that becomes the focus of the summer. Now, the Council of the Federated Organizations, known as COFO, design was to have every single civil rights group, especially the major ones, and other groups that were working on civil rights in the state, be able to be on the one umbrella. We were at a little place up in the Mississippi Delta, far into the Delta, to form this. Under great restraints, late at night, Clarksville, Mississippi, the home of the blues, where a cousin of mine, Robert Johnson, will bring off this music that we call the blues. But right here in this area, where the great W.C. Handy will come through with his fine education and talk about the blues and publish the book. It is in this blue zone that we get Fannie Lou Hamer, who had a nice voice of her own. But I can never forget being called from Hattiesburg, Mississippi, where my focus had been working on the trial of Thurm Lynn, a big fat registrar for 450 pounds, who had not registered a single black PhD even because he said blacks were not qualified to pass Mississippi's literacy test. So we're down there working on that with a federal tribunal meeting in Mississippi for the first time in exactly 100 years under the leadership of Judge Brown out of Texas. But we were there working on that. So I get called up to the Mississippi Delta along with everybody else. He called in everybody. He called in David Dennis, of course, who was coordinating the project at Hattiesburg. So we all come up. We come to the Mississippi Delta, and we are there in a little town called Ruleville, where Emmett Till had also had a grandfather, Emmett Till, the young man who was lynched in 55. Well, we come into this little town. I can tell you, people, it was like a little spot on the globe that you cannot find if you wanted to. A few rows of black houses, about five streets. And then there was one main street, and then there was some white houses, larger than the black houses, of course. And a little country store. There was a service station across the street that the three owners would beat up black men every Saturday because blacks would come to what? They would come out of the fields to any place more urban where they could get something different. And they would let them enjoy themselves and then, of course, jump on them to beat them up. And they could understand why blacks kept coming back. But this was a little small town. I'm in the little small town in the little small church at Ruleville, along with all of the SNCC organizers and with David Dennis. And we're waiting on the SCLC person, James Bevel, who has gotten a bus. And we're going to take... We had 29 people in the church. We thought all of them were going to be going down to Indianola, Mississippi. This is Sunflower County. This is the home of the senator who runs the U.S. Senate, who runs the House Un-American Activities Committee, James O. Eastman. This is Indianola, Mississippi, the home of B.B. King and many of the great blues musicians. We're here.
He was a good friend of LBJ's, wasn't he?
That's right. Very good friend.
Yeah. In fact, he had a phone conversation the same day as Fannie Lou Hamer's statement at the DNC about the deal he had made.
And that's right. Both of the senators, also Senator Stennis,
right,
is a good friend of LBJ's. These are the Southerners, if you will.
Right.
But to talk about James O. Eastman and his madness, and to know that on his huge plantation, which was the biggest welfare plantation probably in the country of Mississippi, James O. Eastman received more than $200,000 in grants every year for not planting, the allotment grants, and other grants for forestation or whatever. In the meanwhile, James O. Eastman had access to Parchman Penitentiary. This is Sunflower County. This is the home of Fannie Lou Hamer. This is in Indianola, Mississippi, the home of B.B. King. This is where the King, James O. Eastman, will rule for more than 40 years from the U.S. Senator. But it is here that he printed his own money, and we got proof of that. We went on that plantation. He would also get prisoners from the prison to come and do his work.
Slave labor, right.
Yes, of course, slave labor. But he also would get men, specifically men who had committed murder. He'd get them because it became a threat to other blacks that when I let him free, I'm going to send him for you. So people were, you know, very nervous all week about Parchman being there, huge prison system, prison, with nothing but slave labor. They would come off and work on many of the farms. Of course, the workers, nobody ever talks about it anymore, white and black, did the free labor for building the infrastructure for the state of Mississippi and the South.
Right.
These were the men that do it. Of course, we got their songs, you know, working on the chain gang and other songs about the labor system, the workers' songs that will come out of the prison system, not just in Mississippi, but across the South. So it was here that we will be in this church where people are frightened to death because the mayor of the town, who is also the chief of the police of the town, I think there were three policemen, he's driving around in his car with a huge gun laid across the back window and across his front seat, a double barrel, and a huge dog. And people were more afraid of the dog than they were of the gun.
Yeah, right.
But they're driving around with like a four-block radar, along with a brother to the man that lynched, one of the men that lynched Emmett Till, who was a policeman in the town. So folk are totally frightened. But courage is being built, and it's being built from these three women who keep singing. And they were singing that song, "Still a little fire burning, no little wheel is turning." I want to talk when Jesus makes it right. They kept singing it. And there was a, you know, like a slow joining in with these three powerful women. And it was not Vicki Gray, and it was not Annie Devine. It was three sisters from the local area singing with Fannie Lou Hamer. I wouldn't know that she was Fannie Lou Hamer until later in the day when I would really get introduced to Mrs. Hamer, who will fire up the National Democratic Convention at Atlantic City in 64. Oh, she was invincible. But Babel was late with the bus, people. So we're waiting on a bus, and the bus is not coming, and we're sitting here waiting. Where is James Babel and this bus? More than 2 hours late. And we're trying to keep the people in the pews. And Bobby said to us that each of us staff members will have to get up and talk. Now, some of us was not good at talking. All of us, but we knew this today, we were going to have to talk at our best because we had to keep the people sitting there on those benches in the church with poor Reverend, who was scared out of the, his Reverend Tucker was scared out of his mind. So he's sitting in the back of the church, and he was like, wow, he would come up from occasionally. So we're looking at this and saying, how do we keep 29 people and their Reverend in a church house? So, of course, you know, I had to go up and speak, and we all had to be, you know, really firing it up. And these sisters were singing so we could fire it up a little bit, get the spirit going up in here. We kept them in there on the benches, and we put 18 of them on the bus for Indianola, Mississippi. And we rolled down, of course. People were singing and jubilant and having a good time on the way down, keeping them fired up. We get to Indianola, where we will spend an entire day trying to see a registrar. Now, these are the southern towns, and everything has the county courthouse and the county buildings and the city buildings all in the square. And everything else is built around the square. So we sit there, and they had benches, and we could sit on the benches. But the folk who went in to register to vote with Bob Moses would sit in the in and out, trying to catch a registrar. Of course, the registrar we knew was not coming, but the point had to be made. Around about 3 in the afternoon, we noticed a phenomenon was taking place, something we hadn't seen in other little towns when we sat in the courthouse square. On the top of the one tall building, and there was only one, a two-story building, were these white men. And they had newspapers, and they were looking down on us. Suddenly, white men came and began to sit on the benches, which we also decided we would occupy, whether they liked it or not. They were reserved for whites. We didn't care. We were young people, and we were there to make a point. We were there to try to get people to register to vote. We were there to begin the process of getting black people in this county and the counties around it engaged in pushing forward around the right to vote, and making the demand and getting the courage and the strength and the character to be able to do these things. But they had these papers, and they're sitting on the bench, and they're reading these things. And it's the Jackson Daily News, one of two newspapers. The other is the Mississippi Clarion Legend, which also comes out of Jackson, is the Jackson Clarion Legend. But they're run by the Edelman brothers, who are very close friends of the President of the United States, John Fitzgerald Kennedy. He refers to them often in his speeches.
Oh, this is in 62,
so,
right?
Here, looking at these papers, so finally, Dory Latna out of Hattiesburg, Mississippi, we were near Hattiesburg, Thomas Crossing. Dory was always a wild girl. And Dory gets up, and she told me, she said, I've had enough. And she reaches over and grabs the white man's paper from him. Said, give me this paper. What are you reading? And why are you looking at me? So, poor man, he froze. I mean, he actually froze in his seat. His leg actually came up, his right leg, and it was, you know, frozen right where she got it. He was scared to put it down, and you could see it. He was looking at us and pushing down on his shoulders and pulling his neck in. And so I'm smiling at him to get him to be nice. That Dory been nasty. I'm going to be nice because I do not feel like being lynched today.
Yeah, right.
Front page headlines, communist. That was Ella Baker's picture. That was James Bell and Diane Nash's picture. That was a picture of Carl and Ann Brayton. All on the front page of this paper, that was Bob Moses, the leader of this movement for the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee and for the Council of Federated Organizations. And he has been identified as what?
A communist. Oh, man.
A communist. It's the James O. Eastland's Red Scare.
Yeah, no kidding.
On the front page in a volatile county, in a volatile time, because white folk are upset that these black folk are all across the state trying to get people to register to vote. Mm-hmm. Engaging people in civil disobedience in some communities.
Even Johnson said that Eastland would, if he were standing in the middle of the worst flood in Mississippi, would say that Negroes did it and they were aided by the communists.
That's correct. No doubt. He accused the Chinese. You know, I saw this when I was sixth grade. I'm one of the last kids in my mother's family that will have Chinese history. Mm. Because Eastland began that thing of the, you know, the yellow plague.
Right.
So they ended Chinese history and took, I don't know why they were having it anyway, and took the books out of the schools. Of course, we had a Chinese community in the state, so I'm assuming that that community was bringing some money into the state of Mississippi, the poorest state in the Union, I might add, owned by the North, Eastern Capital, and Southern Capital, not Midwestern Capital, which was Kennedy Capital.
Right.
So we're sitting here now in this square. I just saw this newspaper, and of course we alerted everybody about it. They'd be passing it around to the other workers, and everybody's eyes are stretching. But Bob is thinking. Jim Bevel is thinking. You can see Bevel jump. Bevel is from a little town called Itabena, Mississippi, though he was raised at Ohio. He went there when he was 12 or 13 years old, from a huge family of more than 20 kids. Mm. So he's thinking about it, and he said to me, he said, Colton, we're going to have to get the hell up out of here. Oh, we got to get out. And I'm thinking, well, he's getting ready to run. I ain't ready to run. I'm ready to fight. Until I looked up, we were sitting on three highways. Highway 61, headed to Chicago. Highway 49 and Highway 51, both headed out of the state into probably Tennessee, across the river into Arkansas, Arkansas on the other side there. And we're sitting here wondering, you know, why are these roads loaded down with highway patrol and police. We can see them with their sticks. So we're here at a tripartite crossing in history, trying to figure out what we're going to do because we're all communists.
Right.
Knowing that there's no excuse for that, that the national press will not respect these black communists organizing in the state of Mississippi as they had with the Young Communist League and others during the 30s and the 40s. They had been pushed down. They had, in fact, been driven out by Eugene McCarthy and the great Red Scare movement that would, in fact, in Hollywood and everybody else in the country. So there were very few people who were willing to say they were communists. In fact, my seventh grade teacher, my first male teacher, had been from the Young Communist League. But he would talk about it privately with you and try to explain to us what communism was in the state where our legislature outlawed words for black schools, like liberty, freedom. I think they might have even outlawed democracy. It was not allowed to teach a black kid about liberty and freedom. It was against the Mississippi state law. So we're sitting here trying to figure out, we just were really puzzled because we go up here, we walk out and walk around to check these highways out at this tripartite intersections in history. So finally, Bob, who was very frightened by now that we should get out, said, Bevel, take Colton indoors. Get them in the car. He said, I know they're not going to be able to get these people from Rubeville out. So just take Colton indoors. Put them in a car. Take them back to Rubeville. Colton indoors you to alert the whole town that we're on the siege. That was to be our job. So we jump in the car with Bevel. Bevel was a wild character. I mean, I can't, if they wanted to define his organizer, he probably never lived, but it's very difficult to define how wild he was because he would get very rational. He got very rational with us. Colder Houston on the outside, Dora Houston in the center, because I was the oldest. So when they grabbed the door, they grabbed the oldest, not the youngest. So I would be able to talk him down, he figured. And since Dora had this little bit of rationality, you know, she's already snatched this white man's newspaper. We get in the car and we head back to Rubeville, but as we head back up the, I can't remember which, it must be 61 that we traveled down on. But anyway, whichever highway, we're on it, we're pushing out, and we're normally going to be dividing from the other highways, headed straight for the highway patrolmen, hundreds of them with sticks in their hands. and they're regular. Some of them had Billy Clips, and most of them looked like they had freshly cut, looked like a 2x4 from some kind of a sawmill or something, and they're standing there, and we headed straight for them. Then we look back over our shoulders, and we see that the bus had tried to pull off, and it has been pulled over on the shoulders of the road, surrounded by highway patrol that came up from one of the other highways. So Bevel switched back around. He said, no, we got to go back. So we go back, and as we get back to this surrounded bus, this yellow bus, Bevel and his braveness, we all jump out of the car because all of us are crazy bad now. We think we're going to go down. You might as well go down swinging, baby. So we get out. Bevel is saying, I'm talking. So he went up and said, why do you have this bus? He demanded to know why the bus is being held. And the officer says to Bevel, they're screaming at him, it's the wrong goddamn color.
Really?
We're arresting this goddamn bus. It's what about the people? They're on the bus, and they ain't coming off. So they arrest the school bus.
Whoa.
We then decided we would do what Bob said. He said, Bevel takes us to Rubio, and he returns back to Indianola. And we began to go through this little town where there are very few people home, except for most of the old people, because people are in the fields. This is 1964. This is the heart of the Mississippi Delta, and people are out working for white folk picking cotton. This is cotton picking season.
Mm.
It is just opening. So we do talk with a few people. We felt like we were out sounding the alarm and running up and down of the Minutemen or something, trying to get the community out, small black community, run them down these side roads. Very short roads, most of them running what we see in New York, a couple of blocks.
Right.
Then around about 6, we get the message that the bus has been freed, and they're on their way back. And they arrived, putting off the people at each one of their plantations as they come in their little homes, if they had little homes. They did here in this little area of Rubio. They're being let out, and the bus, of course, will go on back to Cleveland, Mississippi, where we have a base and where there's also that large Chinese community that had been there since 1842 when they were bringing the railroad through. So we sit and we wait. On the meeting that's to take place, people are trying to get their breath. Timothy Jenkins is a young lawyer, law student out of Yale University, who I was dating at the time. So he and I decided we'd take us a nice walk. It started a slow rain. And you'll hear me say sometimes the history of the slow driving rain, because this little slow rain will come across my life when I'm in Selma. It will come across my life when I'm down in a little county called Simpson County in Mississippi, where my where Robert Johnson's family comes from initially, and where all of my mother's father's people come from. Just a little slow driving rain, meaning a major change is coming in. But as we walk, we decide we walk up through this down these. Through these cotton field roads, because there's a little road that runs through that the tractors or the trucks run through to pick up the cotton. The cotton picker runs before it twists into the field. We hear my name being called. Miss Lido, Miss Lido, Liddell is my last name. So whoever is calling my name has seen it somewhere and is trying now to pronounce it, not knowing, understanding that this Scott name is Liddell. And they are Lidos, but I'm not one of them. It's Fannie Lou Hamer. We're standing here with two sets of waters running down. You could see the tears running from her eyes. And yet the water was just twisting itself, making little pathways across her face, the rain. She said, they're going to keep Pep out there, Pep out there. Pep was her husband. She said, but they're trying to get me to stay on the plantation. And they're trying to get me to agree, and I'm going to go down there and take my register back. So Fannie Lou struggled with pronunciation for words and with the English language. So not just my name, she was struggling now with the word register. To take her register back. But I ain't taking my register back. That same woman who will look us in the face, because Dory will come out and join Timothy and I, standing here in this little slow light rain. Well, this was 62, in August of 64. We'll be standing in Atlantic City before the Democratic National Convention with the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.